Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, and anything really that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
Now, this week we've got a blockbuster special, and that's the podcast as well as the content, let's face it, because it's it's big budget movie adventure time, because there are sailing cinema goers in the Northern Hemisphere, which is obviously the hemisphere that counts, because it's the summer up there right now. So we'll be discussing whether they're worth your time, worth your money, during our winter.
We'll take a look at three of them. Wonder Woman, it's just come out. Is this the movie that'll win critics over to the DC superhero universe?
No.
We'll agree to disagree.
Absolutely, you can be wrong anytime you like, Simon. There's yet another TV show that's been turned into film. This time it's Baywatch. More bronze bodies that you can shake a stick at.
What an image that is. And also full-on fantasy fare. Full on in an attempted fantasy fair with King Arthur, Legend of the Sword.
You don't have to think hard to come up with a genre that's dominated movie making in the last decade or so. Marvel kicked it off back in about 2008 with Iron Man, and superhero movies have been cranked out seriously. I mean, it's like, you know, one after another after another. It's a production line.
It is.
And the speed has been unerring, but the quality? Patchy, isn't it? Let's face it.
Yeah, now, I think so.
Warner Brothers have been making the movies with the DC characters from the DC universe. So we've got Superman and Batman. And they've made good money, but it doesn't mean they've been making good films. And they've generally not been getting good press, certainly, with the either the apotheosis or the nadir, depending on how you choose to think of it, of Suicide Squad. Career Suicide Squad, whenever there was one. But now, in an attempt to redeem themselves, we have Wonder Woman.
Yes.
So, Simon, has a corner been turned?
Well, I think it has, actually. We might disagree on this. I think they have turned a corner. I know that I actually quite enjoyed Wonder Woman. I thought it was pretty good. I thought it went quite a long way to introducing some of the elements that really have been missing, I think, from the DC films so far. And what I'm talking about here is a sense of fun. You're not taking yourself too seriously, not like Batman versus Superman, for example. And also a cast that just gave us some characters who, for most part, I actually ended up caring about. This is just sitting there quite comfortably, Steve, in my tick column. But I can't help but have obviously had a wee read of your review on the Crave website, and I don't think you were that impressed.
Well, no, I wasn't really, to be honest. I mean, here's the thing. People have been saying for a long time, and totally reasonably as well, don't get me wrong, I'm not arguing with this, but people have been saying for a long time that the superhero genre is a profoundly male-oriented genre. And it is. There hasn't been a superhero film made yet that focuses on a female superhero. And so people said, we need a female superhero film. And I'm afraid the old saying, be careful what you wish for, comes into play here. Because we got a female superhero movie. We should have asked for a good female superhero movie.
Oh.
I don't think we got one. Because, look at the story. We'll start with the plot, shall we? Linear, simplistic, barely the slightest hint of a twist at the end. It's quite simplistic. If you know anything at all about the Wonder Woman backstory, you'll know that she's raised on this island, Themyscira, by the Amazons. She's not an Amazon herself, we're told, but she's raised by the Amazons. And she is finally introduced to Manworld by Steve Trevor, an American spy who's shot down by First World War Germans in the water surrounding Themyscira. She saves him from drowning. He tells her about a war. She goes, oh, war? That must be a manifestation of the god Ares, who I'm sworn to kill.
Yes.
Take me to the war. So he,
yes, as you would.
So he takes her to the war. And she then starts fighting a war. But the problem here, this is where my problem starts with the film.
Okay.
He takes her to the war. And then she piggybacks onto his mission, along with a drunken Scottish marksman, an Arab who wears a fez across no man's land, and a North American Indian tracker. Now, it's almost like it's the start of a joke, isn't it? Except the jokes are funny. And this is just weird. And she is part of his gang. She is not leading the mission. She is tagging along on his. She goes along for the ride. This is a film about Steve Trevor and his mates, of whom Diana Prince happens to be one.
Yeah, you could look at it that way, Steve. Let's just start this whole thing about the plot that you're so disappointed with. I mean, all these superhero movies, anyone who's followed them, as you say, would be probably fairly familiar with these characters and where they come from. So I don't think it's so much a matter of dissecting the nuts and bolts of the plot. Really, most people have some idea of it. It's really whether you enjoy the ride or not. Yes, there are some outrageous characters in this film, but I think you approach any superhero movie with the view that please don't take this too seriously or rationally. None of this is going to make a hell of a lot of sense. So I just thought where it did work is that these characters, as stupid as they may have been on paper, bounced off each other rather well. And just that sense of not taking yourself that seriously. And that was mainly due to the aforementioned Chris Pine as Steve Trevor, Steve Trevor, who I agree with you, I thought was really good. I mean, he just had a lot of depth to what he was portraying on Should I put my teeth in?
Why not?
Yes, on screen, and I enjoyed his performance. And
he's without doubt the high point of the film.
Well, okay, and that you say that, and implicit in what you say, Steve, is a criticism of Gal Gadot, who played Wonder Woman, Diana Prince. I take it
very much. I mean, she's absolutely gorgeous. She's very dramatic and balletic in these beautifully filmed fight sequences. But when she's trying to act, concerned, she looks like, if she looked any more confused puppy, her head would start tilting to the side. That's the one look she does. He can carry a film. She can't.
Okay, this is where I'm going to come in and have a bit of an argument with you. I think the problem is the Wonder Woman character here, Steve. Very similar to, I guess, the Superman character. He's just a goody-good two-shoes. He's not got a lot of light and shade to his basic personality. He's just out there to do good. I think that's potentially a very boring character.
Yes.
And the way that they've tried to do something with it in this film is to show her as being utterly naive at the beginning, knowing nothing about the modern world, nothing about men.
And I accept that at that point, when she arrives in London with Steve, and they're doing the fish out of water stuff, they spark off each other really quite well. Yeah, I like that aspect of it. That was what I enjoyed in this film.
Okay. Oh, well, see, you agree with me. Hooray.
Up to a point.
And I just thought, so that was her raison d'etre for, maybe looking a little blank at times, was because it was all rather new and didn't fit in with her previous world view. But I thought towards the end, as things start to develop between the two main characters, maybe my eyes were deceiving me, but I thought I saw a little bit of development in her character and the connection she had with Steve Trevor. So I didn't mind that. And the film was assisted, Steve, I thought, with some very good other support players, in particular the actress Lucy Davis, who played Etta. This is Steve Trevor's foil secretary type person.
Oh, she's wonderful.
She did a fantastic comic turn and really lifted that sort of light, gave the film the lightness that it needed, as did some of the other characters, like the Scottish marksman played by Ewan Bremner. I thought he had a few good moments. So, I think it, there's always this big given in superhero movies, you not to be taken too seriously. I got some enjoyment out of those other characters and the main relationship between Steve Trevor and Diana Prince.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. You can't take it seriously. I mean, a man flying, utterly preposterous. A man who's basically made of iron, utter nonsense.
Yes.
A woman who marches across no man's land defending off bullets from a machine gun with her magic bangles.
Yes.
Is unfortunately, people were laughing out loud in the cinema when I saw this.
Oh, were they?
Oh, yes. And I was, I'll admit, one of them. But one thing that you have to do in a film like this, when you're creating fantasy, is you can make it as implausible as you want, so long as it's logically consistent. And we are told three things that cannot exist together. One, she is not an Amazon. Two, only an Amazon can kill Ares. Three, she's out to kill Ares.
Yes. Okay, I see where you're going.
You can't square that circle. And that's kind of indicative of the whole film, is I don't know that the story... And this is great, because, you know, my usual criticism of things like Batman versus Superman is that the story is so utterly labyrinthine that it's impossible to follow. But I think in Wonder Woman, they went in the opposite direction. Yeah, you've got a very straightforward, very linear story that's very... But it's simplistic, and that was the problem. But it wasn't. It also wasn't internally consistent.
It probably wasn't. I don't know if many of these films are particularly internally consistent.
Well, you can't tell most of the time, can you?
No, you can't. I would still say, you might have some fair points there, but I'd still say at the end of this, I just enjoyed most of the performances, and I enjoyed the way most of the characters bounced off each other. And I felt I did care for the characters more so than I did in some of the previous films, certainly like, say, Suicide Squad, which you mentioned earlier. So I'm still going to leave my tick where it sits, and we're just going to have to carry on this little... later.
Well, see, I'm inclined, because obviously I trust and respect your opinions here, to go back and give it another look. But that would mean having to watch it again, and I'm not sure I can bring myself to do that.
One thing I couldn't help but think, Steve, just quickly before we must move on, but these films, you know, when you watch enough of these films, you see them kind of seemingly borrowing from each other all the time. The whole sequence of, as you said, Steve Trevor leading this band of brothers, including Diana Prince, behind enemy lines during the war, so much was evocative of the first Captain America movie, which had exactly the same scenario of Captain America leading a band of brothers against the Nazis that was in the Second World War, but very, very similar feel and setting. So,
oh, look, if we're going to start playing spot the influence in this film, we could do this until the next one comes out. I mean, I saw The Matrix, I saw anything by Guy Ritchie, I saw a lot of Harry Potter in there. There's a lot of crossovers.
There are. So, I'm going to say, yes, it's worth spending your money if you're into this type of genre, of course. That's a given.
I would agree with you, provided we add that caveat, because it's not for everyone.
No, indeed.
Right then.
Right. So, Steve, another movie that's been released very recently, just in the last few days, and this is another attempt, and I don't know how many there have been, I've lost count, of someone trying to turn an iconic TV show into a successful movie.
Right.
Right. I mean, what, Man from U.N.C.L.E., just Get Smart. I mean, the list is
Starsky
endless.
Starsky and Hutch, 21 yeah. Jump Street, you name it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this time, it's Baywatch. They haven't brought back, thank goodness, David Hasselhoff, although maybe that might have helped. But in this case, it's Dwayne Johnson. He's a bit of an everyman these days, isn't he? He's heading this new crew on the beach. You've just seen it, Steve. Did you... were you inspired to head for some sand, nearby sand, with your suntan lotion bottle?
No. Simple as that. No, I'm not being fair, to be honest. I mean, look, let's get something out of the way first of all. You talk about David Hasselhoff, so obviously you're very familiar with Baywatch. Have you ever seen an episode of it?
I might have seen one a long, long time ago. So long ago, I don't really remember it. But I said the word iconic, because he is kind of a, good or bad, he is an iconic bloke, isn't he? He's just stayed around in the public.
I have asked a lot of people in the last fortnight, have they ever actually... Oh, Baywatch. Oh, yeah, know all about Baywatch. Oh, so you've seen an episode, have you? No. Nobody's willing to admit to ever actually having seen it. But everyone knows...
it wasn't any good.
Well, there is that, yeah. But everyone knows about it. As you say, it is actually iconic. It's deep in people's consciousnesses.
Yeah.
And so it was ripe for the picking. It really was. And I like Dwayne The Rock Johnson. You have to give him his full name, don't you?
You do.
There's something about him. He has a delightful on-screen charm. You can't not like a film he's in.
Yeah, I agree with that. He's very watchable, I agree.
He really is. He's got a very endearing... I mean, there's nothing offensive about him. You like films he's in. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a good film, but it sort of predisposes you toward liking him. And basically, Baywatch is two films at once.
Right.
It's odd. On the one hand, you've got he plays Mitch, which by amazing coincidence was the name of David Hasselhoff's character in the original. And I stress that I did not know this until I actually did a bit of research for my review. But he plays Mitch Buchanan, who's the head of Baywatch at Emerald Bay, which I'm assuming is probably where the original page was set. So Zac Efron rocks up for the tryouts for this year's intake of new Baywatchers. And he's an entitled, spoiled brat who was a disgraced ex-Olympic swimmer who thinks he's entitled to a place on the team. And yes. And obviously, you can probably sketch out that progression just from that description.
Yeah.
Starts off with massive tension between them, and they end up like brothers at the end, obviously. You can see where that's going. Zac Efron brings a reasonable amount of charm to it. Not spectacular, but you know he's not bad. And he's carried by Johnson quite beautifully, so it works very, very well. And you've got a few others. You've got John Bass plays Ronnie, who is a schlubby geek who's just desperate to join the crew because he's passionately in love with CJ, which apparently was Pamela Anderson's character way back when, played way, way, way more gorgeously by Kelly Rohrbach.
Okay.
And he's very much in love with her, quite understandably. And there's that film. And that film is really, really enjoyable. It's fun. Okay. It's very self-aware. At one point, as I say, you know, Kelly Rohrbach is bouncing along the beach in a very bouncily, bouncy kind of way, as you'd imagine, and you know,
I seem to recall Pamela Anderson was known for that, bouncing along the beach.
Precisely, yes.
Yes. Yes.
And so you've got her long hair, and you've got every other bit of her bouncing along. You've got, you know, the swimsuit, the zip that's permanently stuck half an inch above her navel, but never seems to pop open somehow. And so you can picture this scene quite nicely. And so a couple of the others turn to each other and say, "Is it just me, or should you really look like she's running in slow motion?"
Right.
So it's very knowing, and it's very self-aware, it's great fun. That works.
Okay.
But that's not enough to sustain a 90-minute feature film. And this is a two-hour film.
Right,
and so they bolt on a story. And that's where it fails.
Yeah, and it tries to become a bit of a crime thriller in this part of the story, doesn't it?
You know, well, exactly,
new owner of a nightclub or something comes along, and is she dealing, or is she not dealing in drugs and so forth?
Yeah, so this is Victoria Leeds, played by Priyanka Chopra, who is, yeah, she's a local businesswoman trying to buy up all the properties on the beach because she's suspected of drug dealing. And so Mitch decides that Baywatch are going to become the drug enforcement agency. And people even tell him, no, that's not what Baywatch should be doing. And you're sitting there in your seat going, yeah, it really isn't what you should be doing, is it?
No.
Because this is rubbish. And when they're doing that stuff, it fails woefully. It doesn't work. It's boring. It's plodding. It's not particularly funny. It doesn't work. When they go back to being Baywatch, yeah, it's great. A lot of laughs. It's very well played. It's really good. You know, there's some very, very immature, very, very childish knob gags, which are very, very well done. It's fun.
Okay.
And then at the end, we do get the obvious cameos, and it all wraps up neatly. And you end up thinking, why was this film even made?
Well, there seems to be this sort of yearning and aching, a feeling that they just can't not remake some old TV programs. Someone in Hollywood thinks that the public's crying out for it. Well, I'm not sure if they are.
Who on earth sat there in their office one day and said, you know what we need more than anything else, what the world needs most right now? A Baywatch film.
Yeah. Well, one thing I wondered, I haven't had a chance to see the whole film yet, Steve, but I have watched quite a few clips from it. Back in the day, I guess, attitudes towards scantily clad women running along beaches were a little different back in the 70s or 80s, whenever this was running. But maybe views have changed a little bit now. Was that done, as you say, in a self-knowing, tongue-in-cheek way, so that we were not really meant to be taking the objectification of women seriously, or did it cross a line, do you think?
Well, no, they actually handled that one really quite well. Yes, obviously, you can't make Baywatch without a gorgeous blonde who's spilling out of a very, very interestingly cut swimsuit,
right,
jiggling along the beach. That's part of it. It wouldn't be Baywatch without that. But there's probably more male flesh on display than there is female.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, you've got Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who is unfeasibly large. But then you've also got Zac Efron, there's one scene where they're doing like an exercise off between the two of them, and he's got his shirt off. And he's showing off his pecs and his abs and the other muscles that unfeasibly ripped people have. And he's grotesque.
Right.
It looks deformed. But you see more ripped male flesh. The women keep the clothes on.
Okay.
In fact, the only nudity in the film is male nudity.
Okay.
Handled for laughs in a morgue. So it's they do it very knowingly.
And it's
equal opportunities leering.
Right. Okay. That's just a question that one couldn't help but wonder about as I was watching the various highlights of this film.
Oh, it's okay, so, entirely reasonable question, and it's not bad.
Yeah. Okay. All right then. So I'm half tempted to catch it, but probably not.
If you go to the cinema and the film that you want to see is sold out and there's tickets left for that, then go and see it. But don't make a special trip. It's not that good.
Okay. I think that's a very nice way of putting it. Right, let's go on to our third film.
Right, I think this is a film that you and I are actually going to agree on this time.
I think it is, yes.
Yeah, yeah. King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, in it.
In it.
British director Guy Ritchie, who knows a thing or two about fast-paced adventure movies, because he's a bit of a geezer, isn't he? A bit dodgy, a bit ways, a bit ducking, a bit of diving, you know what I mean? And he tries his end at the fantasy genre, doesn't he? And Simon, how does he do?
The funny thing about that is, mate.
Right.
Oh, we're going to stop this, don't we?
Well, to be fair, we're doing it better than Charlie Hunnam did.
Yeah. Well, look, you know what? I actually think this came up wanting. I did. I just. It has got a big budget. Guy Ritchie does bring his, you know, that quirky style he has, that the way he directs action and comedy. But the story was flat. And I honestly, I felt it straight away. And it's that feeling hasn't left me, Steve. I was occasionally bored by chunks of this film. I just felt...
Well, you and I saw it together, didn't we? I heard you sighing and harumphing.
Yeah, well, this is a very well-worn trail, this fantasy-type story. King Arthur's a well-known story. More than that, the world has for some years now been consumed by one of the most well put together, produced, acted, and written fantasy productions, the long-running Game of Thrones.
Oh, yes.
And that has entranced millions and done it with a great deal of class, I think. And any film that dares dip its toe into those waters can't help but be compared to Game of Thrones, I would argue. And they went ahead and dragged a couple of Game of Thrones actors into this film, and in so doing, made such a comparison even more obvious. And even for that reason, more than any other, some of my boredom arose, because I just thought, man, there's a much, much better example of this out there. And this just didn't engage with me at all, I'm sad to say.
Well, again, apparently there are actually quite literally two films being made in here, from what I've heard.
Yeah.
You've got, on the one hand, you've got the origin story of Arthur, who's a bit of a geezer.
Yes.
And the story there is that when his father, Uther Pendragon, is being overthrown by the very, very, very naughty Uncle Vortigern, phoned in, quite frankly, by Jude Law.
Well, yeah, I was going to talk about that, but you go ahead. Yeah.
He's then vanquished off, and he's raised in a brothel in old Londinium Tan. And when you've got that bit going on, you've got the origin story, and you've got Guy Ritchie being able to have a little bit of fun telling his tale of how King Arthur is raised as you know, a bit of a backstreet geezer in London. And that's when Guy Ritchie does his thing, and he does it really well. You remember there's a couple of moments when he's actually trying to recount a tale, this is Arthur, trying to tell a tale of something that happened that afternoon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's a fantastic piece of Guy Ritchie's signature filmmaking.
It was a bit Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels.
Wasn't it just? In fact, I'm finding myself wanting to re-download that film and watch it tonight because it was that good. And when it was being that film, it was great fun. And again, you've got the characters, like, you know, you've got Aidan Gillen, who obviously is Peter Baelish from Game of Thrones, as Goose Fat Bill. Now, there's a Guy Ritchie character if ever there was one.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, you've also got this ridiculous Legend of the Sword nonsense going on. And that was actually apparently a separate film at one point.
Okay. You know, I agree with you that the part that worked best was that geezer part and that sort of bit of a camaraderie and the bouncing off each other, the characters around in old Londinium, and the mateship between Arthur and his crew.
Yes.
But you just mentioned that's a couple of scenes where he does a retelling of a story and he's very fast intercutting. And you have one character almost speaking another character's voice to say, I said this to him and they said that to them. Now, we were talking about cross-pollination before, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, exactly the same little gimmick was used just a year or two back in another Marvel film called Ant-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And down to the – and unfortunately, I saw Ant-Man – not unfortunately, I saw Ant-Man. And when Guy Ritchie assailed us with his little storytelling technique, it just for me, anyway, I just started seeing this the other film's sequence. And so it was extremely derivative, and if not to say stole it, although I'm not saying Ant-Man was the first to try it. So I guess that the problem with these days is all these little things you've probably seen somewhere before, and you've got to really put other stuff out of your mind, otherwise you're going to be thinking of 10 films as you're watching one. But having said that, that part of the film worked best, and yes, the power plays about the sword and taking back his claiming his true inheritance from the bad guy King Vortigern, and Jude Law just did not give us a very convincing bad guy, I'm sad to say.
He wasn't trying very hard, was he?
No, there was a sort of Nazi-style salute. I almost burst out laughing myself. It just was... No, didn't do it.
No, I mean, I know what you're talking about. There's, you know, the Hail Vortigern scene. And yeah. And you're thinking, okay, this is such broad strokes. There's no subtlety. There's none of the wit and the intelligence that Ritchie's capable of.
Yeah. And again, you'd only think of someone like I don't want to go overboard on the Game of Thrones thing, but when you have a bad guy, person character like Cersei in Queen of Game of Thrones, just superb as drawing out the all the subtleties of her malevolence and her cruelty, and Jude Law. Admittedly, it's a short film compared to a seasons long running TV series, but nevertheless, that felt very comic book, actually, didn't it?
It did a little bit, yes. And you say short film, it was 2 hours long. It wasn't, it felt longer.
It did
feel longer. And like I say, you've got Aidan Gillen basically playing Peter Baelish, playing Goose Fat Bill.
Yeah.
And you've got Charlie Hunnam, who, okay, he's from Newcastle. He's a Geordie. And we're asking a Geordie to do a London accent. And why, man, he's not very good at it. And he sounded it. I thought that I'm not very good at Geordie accents, as you've just seen, to be fair. But at least I don't try and get paid to do one. He sounded like English wasn't his first language at some point.
I'll give you that. And there were these odd little comic turns here and there. David Beckham pops up. Am I allowed to say that?
You are. Yeah, that's fairly well known. To be fair, though, in Ritchie's defence, he's got form in that in that department.
He, has he? Okay, I thought actually Beckham did quite well, actually.
Oh, Beckham did better than Hunnam did, if you ask me. But if you mention Ritchie's earliest films, your Lock, Stock and your films like that, and he had Vinnie Jones.
From
Wimbledon.
Yep.
In there as well. He's obviously Guy Ritchie, despite being a nice rich kid from Hertfordshire, he wants to be a geezer.
Yeah.
And he wants to make films about geezers, and he wants to put geezers in his films, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I can't help myself. I keep slipping into it every time I do.
You do.
Because I wanted the film to be that film, but it wasn't.
No, I made a note afterwards, not long after coming out of it, the film, and I thought there was too much levity for it to be a serious drama, but there wasn't enough comedy for it to be a real good comic romp, and I just thought it fell in between the two,
didn't it? Just
and it fell flat, sadly.
It did, and when you've got acting talent like Jude Law, who really is capable of better, to be fair. And also, I think it's worth mentioning, I'm going to need to check his name to make sure I get this right, because I didn't realise, and you recognised him, and I had to ask you afterwards who it was. Jack's Eye, the guard, was played by Michael McElhattan.
Yes, yes. So he was He was Lord Bolton in Game of Thrones, the chap who was, in the end, you know, led the betrayal of the Starks at the Red Wedding.
Yes.
The famous scene. And he later gets killed by his bastard son. So he was around in Game of Thrones for quite a long time. Yeah, so when you had two Game of Thrones characters, actors in that series.
He was fantastic. He's, instead of the absolutely clinical, cynical evil of Lord Bolton, you had a much, much nastier character. For my money, he was the high point of the film.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yeah. So all in all, though, this film, it's been out long enough for us to be able to say, Steve, that it's actually been a bit of a commercial flop.
Yes.
And I'd have to say with good reason.
Well, apparently, Ritchie has been signed up to, I think, do six more.
Blimey.
Because if you remember...
Cool. Are you serious, mate? Are you?
Yeah, you're having a laugh or what? God, blimey. Yeah. Hell. Half a dozen of them. Do me a favour.
Do me a favour.
Taking bloody liberties, aren't they? Yeah. Now, apparently he's been signed up to do half a dozen of these. And what I'm hoping is, if enough people don't buy tickets, we won't encourage them, will we?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, then. All right, that's all right. Shall we move on, shall we, Cobber?
Yeah, right you are, mate, yeah. Now, Cobber? Cobber? You bloody Australians. Now, I think we should move on away from that one as fast as we possibly can and never speak of this ever again.
Yes. Now, look, I of course, on our website, cravepodcast.com, there's a good list compiled by Steve of concerts and other events coming up. So you please go to our website to check that out. But Steve, while we've got you, any other highlights of films and concerts coming up the next little while we should be aware of?
The big news that's been floating around in the last week is, I think basically Ed Sheeran now owns Dunedin. Yes. He's announced more dates. He's now doing four dates at the Forsyth Barr Stadium in Dunedin. That's the big news. The big show coming up in Auckland, of course, is Boney M, which you've mentioned several times already, but we just have to mention it because it's just hilarious. But there's not a huge amount coming out. We're settling into the winter now. There's not much going on. Evan Dando, later the Lemonheads, was meant to be playing in Auckland last night, but didn't make it into New Zealand.
Right.
No one's saying why.
Yes.
And then, of course, at the Wonder Woman screening, they did previews of the next Wonder Woman featuring film.
Well, that's right. But we didn't say that. This is all part of the DC Universe's attempt to match Marvel's Avengers. So the Wonder Woman film does lay yet another little piece of the puzzle towards a Justice League film,
indeed,
which is coming out, I think, at the end of the year. So
yes, and they did trailer. They showed the trailer for Justice League. And it's fascinating to see a character from the film you're about to watch in a trailer for a film that's coming out later in the year as well. And you just sort of realise what an absolutely monumental juggernaut this is.
Oh, totally, totally.
Yeah.
Speaking of juggernaut, other big sort of budget movies are just around the corner. Another trailer we saw was Tom Cruise's latest, The Mummy.
Oh, Lord, I have to go and see that next week.
I think we're only a few weeks away from another Marvel one. We were talking about Guardians of the Galaxy just a week or two back, but Marvel's take on Spider-Man is coming out, I think, in 3 or 4 weeks.
We're always a couple of weeks away from another Marvel film. That's just a given these days. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, again, cravepodcast.com is our website. A lot more information there.
Now, Simon, Steve, what else has been turning up at cravepodcast.com?
Well, funny you should mention that, because I was going to say, of course, there are ways that to get in touch with us. And in our last podcast, I had a bit of a rant about Alien Covenant, or Covenant, depending on which side of the bridge you come from, and in particular its predecessor, Prometheus. And I was really confused by Prometheus even after 2 or 3 years down the track. And I did say, if you've got any thoughts on that, please let us know. So I've heard from someone. Isn't that nice?
Someone's actually explained Alien Prometheus to you. Wow. You've not heard from Ridley Scott, have you? No, I don't think he understands it either.
No. I was chatting with Stu. Stu Colson runs an Auckland business called Heroes for Sale, which deals with the sci-fi and fantasy genre and superhero genre and books and graphic novels and the like. And he and I were chatting about it, and he was kindly put his thoughts on paper. So just quickly, what Steve was saying was – not Steve, Stu – was saying that none of the Alien movies make any sense if they are about us humans.
Okay.
There's a profound statement. There has to be a bigger story, and us as humans are just a side note. So in Alien Covenant, we get to the point where we figure out that Earth, if you remember, Steve, was almost some sort of testing facility for the engineer's weapons.
Yes.
So my friend Stu was saying, well, maybe we should just consider us humans as just an accidental plot twist in a much bigger saga of these so-called engineers. And, you know, because really creating a weapons factory planet to take out life on our planet doesn't make much sense.
No.
So what he's saying is there's a much bigger war going on between different factions of the engineers across the whole universe, spanning all sorts of star systems, and we're just a little minute part of that. And don't take it too seriously. I think that's kind of another one of our themes for this podcast this time. Don't take these films too seriously. He says the makers have been, you know, the engineers have been traveling the stars for millennia, and if humanity is anything to go by, factions will occur. The expansion into outer space will create a rush for resources, etc., in the same way England and Russia fought for the spoils of Afghanistan. This time, whole planets or even star systems are split among the rival factions. Does that help you at all? Possibly not.
Well, it's like I said about Wonder Woman earlier. It kind of makes me want to go back and rewatch, but then it means I'd have to go watch it again.
Yeah, although I think you thought Alien Covenant was better than Prometheus, if I recall our previous chat.
Yeah, but that's like saying that, you know, smallpox is slightly better than tertiary syphilis. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a good thing.
Ooh, a cutting remark. Okay, let's wrap this up before I countercut. If you want to get in touch with us, we're doing it. Edit. See, that's going to be an edit. If you like to get
professional broadcaster, years and years behind the microphone, and this is what we get.
If you have any other thoughts you'd like to raise with us, any views, you can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Well done.
Thank you.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
And please do. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.